Today I want to talk about battlefield casualties. The first thing I want to do is provide a caveat. I use a handy and convenient way of describing emotional states, almost as if they're a 10-step ladder or stairway. It goes from the bottom level up to the top level. And starting at the bottom, it's shame, then apathy, then grief, then fear, then lust, then anger, then pride. And the top three are labeled courageousness, acceptance, and peace. It's convenient in that it's clear, and it is also easy to remember with the first letters of each of those words. SAG, S-A-G, FLAP, F-L-A-P, and CAP. I personally think that we tend to bounce around from step to step throughout the day, and we can interpret incoming signals, that is, inputs or environmental signals, based upon being on any one of those steps. If we're in anger, then we're going to tend to filter environmental signals or inputs from a position of anger. We will tend to see those things as threatening. And so recognize we also tend to offer opinions and points of view based upon that level. So this is really explaining that I'm about to deal with a subject that can cause me to bounce around from step to step, from emotional state to emotional state, and you should recognize it as such. You don't need to take in this energy. You don't need to agree with this energy. This is more for my benefit of expressing it and for your consideration. So the idea of battlefield casualties. Now, my personal opinion is that we should all be living to 120 and healthy at least, or have the choice to live to whatever age we choose and healthy. I think we've been mistrained, mistaught, and as a result of that mistraining, that miseducation, we tend to remove ourselves from the stream of well-being. It's almost like it's a river that it will take us to well-being if we stay in that flow, but we get coaxed out of the river, and then we disconnect from that stream of well-being. And as a result of that dissociation from that stream of well-being, we increase the risk of us becoming battlefield casualties. When I served 6 years in the military, I was in the U.S. Army, I didn't have combat experience. I am both extremely grateful that I didn't, and I'm a little bit disappointed that I didn't. My gratitude is based upon my opinion that seeing the results of war, and on not only on Americans, but on the, in that time, on Vietnamese, and the result on myself, the decisions I would have made as an officer, and the regret or guilt I would have had regarding those that I, things I did or things that I didn't do, that I was spared that tremendous amount of emotional, mental, spiritual, and perhaps physical destruction is an incredible blessing to me. On the other hand, my disappointment is that I perceived I would have had a chance to experience a trial by fire, literally and figuratively, and I could have identified more of who I was. However, it seems pretty clear that I would have been playing a game that was structured by somebody else and not of my own doing. Now, I would have volunteered for it. I was a volunteer in the military. I enlisted. I wasn't drafted. So I was there because of a decision that I made. But I would have been experienced that, a war that on the one hand, we were told it was absolutely essential to stop the communist expansion, and on the other hand, seemed to so many people that participated in that, including a younger brother of mine, saying it was meaningless and it was foolish and we had no right being there in the first place. I just returned recently from a stand-down in Salisbury, Maryland. The stand-down is an event that is designed to help veterans regain stability, regain a sense of balance, to be able to reacclimate to civilian life, if in fact they ever were acclimated in the first place. Some of those vets are suffering from their casualties of being on the battlefield. They're physically wounded. In some cases, you could see the results of their surgeries on their bodies. Some of them were emotionally wounded, spiritually wounded, mentally wounded by what they experienced, what they saw, what they did, what they saw other people do, and so on. And so the idea that we were there trying to help discharge some of the energy that they would have accumulated in their experience in an effort to regain their balance was the overall purpose. And I was pleased to be there, and I was pleased with the results that we were able to facilitate in our veterans. Now, some of these veterans were from the Vietnam era. That's quite a long time ago. Some of them were from the Gulf War. Some of them from the current war in Iraq or Afghanistan. So they were casualties of these various battlefields. But when we look at it, are these battlefields only the geographic territories that are in Iraq or the Gulf or in Afghanistan or Vietnam or Southeast Asia and one of those other countries? Or are there different battlefields? I think there are different battlefields. One of the things we were interested in dealing with when we were in Salisbury, Maryland, was the issue of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Now, PTSD is a very large problem for veterans returning from either Iraq or Afghanistan, and it has been a problem probably forever, although in different times. For instance, in World War I, this condition was called shell shock or battle fatigue, but it's now recognized as PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And so when you think of it, it is a very large problem for these veterans who are returning to the United States from these war zones. But the prevalence of PTSD in the United States really is not veterans. It is with women. Women are judged to be a total of about 1 million of them in the United States right now suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And these are not talking, I'm not talking about women that were in the military. I'm talking about women that were not in declared war zones. So what battlefields are these women casualties of? And who else is participating in the conflict? And why? I think these are important questions, but first let's explore the background a little bit. If you have been on one of these Sunday talks or you listen to the recording, you recognize that I recently was in Poland. Poland's history is filled with a variety of conflicts, with a variety of countries and ethnicities doing battle in that physical space, in that geography. It includes Germans in Germany, Swedes in Sweden, Russia, Hungary, Tartars, Mongols, and others. All kinds of people sweeping across the terrain of Poland at war. One of the problems with Poland, of course, is it's between this geographic space currently referred to as Germany and the one currently referred to as Russia. Because my mother's family was from this general area, and I'm interested in genealogy, I've started to become more interested in discovering more about my roots. And if you've been on these calls, you recognize that I think healing our roots, healing our history, is tremendously valuable in terms of achieving peace, success, health, and happiness. So, because my mother's family comes from this part of continental Europe, I wanted to know more about it. And so some of the paperwork that I've come across, death certificates, for instance, and birth certificates, and even immigration information, indicated a couple or three different locations. Today, those locations are within the borders of Poland. But when my mother's mother and my mother's father were born and grew up in that area, some of those areas were in Germany, and some of those areas were labeled as Russia. And so I'm interested in that sort of thing now, trying to understand more about that. My wife's relatives, who we visited in Poland and whom I met for the very first time, and I was thrilled at that relationship as it developed, gave me a gift of a book called Warsaw Unvanquished. Warsaw Unvanquished. It is a historical book, and it's a picture book done by a famous photographer. And so woven throughout it was some history and these pictures of less than the standard tourist kind of things, as well as having a very elaborate timeline that detailed the history of this area of Europe that we now refer to as Poland. And it was amazing to see the ebb and flow of who controlled what and who was doing battle with what and so on. And so it was very interesting to me trying to establish my roots. The other day, quite accidentally, here in Naples, Florida, and fortuitously, when I was at my dentist's office waiting to have my teeth cleaned, I saw a bookshelf, and looking for a magazine, they didn't have anything of interest, so I noticed on the bookshelf a book called Poland, which turns out to be a historical novel written by James Michener. I've never read anything written by James Michener, but I'm familiar with him as an author, at least in name only. And so the hygienist said to me, you can take that book and read it and bring it back. That's what it's there for. And so that was interesting to me how that came to be there. Anyway, I attracted it, is the way I think of it. I took the book home and started to look at it. My wife said years ago she had read it and didn't find it of interest, didn't really care for his writing. I have different information needs than my wife, so I started to read it, and very quickly, even in the introduction before the book began, he explained how he came to write it. James Michener hired a bunch of experts to develop their history. This was their fields of expertise. They were experts, professors and so on, authors and so on, dealing with the history, the sociology, the politics, warfare, agriculture, economy, on and on and on and on, regarding Poland. So I guess Michener was looking for that kind of background, because he didn't speak Polish, and he wanted to be able to have rich detail that was factual in nature in order to weave in his imagined protagonists and antagonists into a story. So the background is factual. And so as I'm reading this, it's very interesting to me to be learning things about the Catholic Church and Polish and the government and the communists, which is how this starts out. Very interesting. So chapter one starts in times that are communist controlled. This is post-World War II. And that's where it begins. But then in chapter two, it reverts to about 1100 A.D. And it starts talking about what life was like back then, based in fact, but with some characters purely fictional. And it was very interesting to me. And what occurred to me as I'm reading this is that the serfs in this neck of the woods, they were called peasants, as they were in lots of different areas. Other parts of Western Europe, they were referred to as serfs, but they're basically peasants, uneducated, just barely getting by, working on land owned by some authority figure, some, quotes, royalty, somebody who had the backing of the church, in this case, or other political leaders. And so they worked on land that belonged to somebody else, for somebody else, and the great majority, sometimes I think one of the figures was, 220 days of the year was worked on for the benefit of the owner of the land, and another portion of the time, 50 or so days of the year, was worked on for the benefit of the religious leaders of that area, and a very small portion of the time was worked on the land for the benefit of the peasant and his own family. Uneducated, barely surviving, subsistence level food, in hovels with no windows or doors and dirt floors and so on. When it came time for war, that is, to engage in battles on battlefields, it was the responsibility of the peasants that were able-bodied men to do what the landowner told them to do, to battle the enemies established or declared by the landowner. So they were battling enemies that the landowner said were enemies for the purposes of protecting the land of the landowner. Not for protecting themselves or their families, but to protect somebody else. And after the war, if they didn't die in that war, and they weren't casualties in one form or another, they could return to the land of the landowners and go back to farming the land of the landowner for the benefit of the landowner. And so when you look at this, you go, the poor, uneducated people are going to war for the benefit of the landowners the more educated, the more powerful, the richer. Yes, that's true. The poor and uneducated were used by the more educated, by the richer, by the more powerful, to serve them. And you just go, And if you start examining what's going on here, and you can look at who is in the United States military, for example, you will recognize that, by and large, it is the people that are less educated, have less economic opportunity, have less opportunity overall, have fewer options, are the ones that are populating the ranks of the U.S. Army, U.S. Navy, U.S. Marines. And you go, These people are being coaxed, cajoled, manipulated, talked into going to war against an enemy. Now, what is the enemy? Certainly, in a case like Vietnam, you can pretty much look at, we're going into Vietnam, a different territory, someplace else. In theory, we're doing it for the good guys, that is one group of Vietnamese, against the bad guys, another group of Vietnamese. But we're in their home territory, we're on their battlefield, battling whom? Not the rich and not the powerful, but we're battling the uneducated and the poor who have very limited options, who are being cajoled, encouraged, manipulated into battling the other group of enemies, who are, in this case, people coming from the West, trying to occupy, take our territory, kill us, keep our women, and so on. So now we're poor people battling poor people for the benefit of whom? Well, if you would turn around and look at any one of these war efforts and see who is making the money off of the war effort, it is not the soldier carrying the weapon. He or she is not the one benefiting from these wars. And in fact, it is the person selling the guns and the bullets to our military establishment is the one making the money. They're the ones benefiting from the war. And on the other side, it is people selling the guns and the bullets to those other poor, educated organizations that are benefiting from this war. When we start looking at all of these different patterns of who's battling who, it becomes clear that certainly with the homeless situation in America with regards to the veterans, particularly of Vietnam era when we have a greater level of statistics, the homeless when they returned from Vietnam were not welcomed back as heroes, but in fact spit upon and despised. Tremendous level of homelessness, inability to assimilate back into civilian life for a variety of reasons, the inability to function economically or socially led to homelessness, and worse, the tremendously high level of suicides of Vietnam veterans. I recently read a statistic that said that more Vietnam veterans have committed suicide than Vietnam veterans killed in Vietnam. That is scary to think of the terms of those two groups of casualties of the Vietnam War. And there's the third group of casualties, those that are still limping along, physically or emotionally or mentally or spiritually, but haven't died either in Vietnam and haven't yet died. They are in this kind of semi-dead state because of our inability and our unwillingness to help them get back to life. Those battlefield casualties are the one that are so disheartening. There are a lot of aspects of this that are problematic for me. I guess what I'm really saying is they're disturbing, and I'm unsure as to what to do about it. But when I look around and see, and I've gotten a couple of emails in the last couple of days, and that's what provoked the subject matter, is I got an email from a woman who I don't know very well, but I think she's well-intentioned. But this is the second email that stresses that government is the enemy. Government is the enemy. And I don't think government is the enemy. And I don't think some of these other enemies that are promoted to us, that are marketed to us, are the enemies either. And it is our willingness to think about this and distinguish who is the enemy, rather than just to accept one that has been marketed to us or handed to us because it is convenient, is to be able to say, is it really the enemy? Were the Vietnamese, were the Viet Cong the enemy? And perhaps they are. But is there a better way? Is there a more effective way to win this, quotes, war, end quotes, rather than to sacrifice our poor and uneducated men and women? Is there a better way? Well, maybe not more profitable for a certain group of people, but better for the people who are going to be killed or maimed or damaged in some other way. Who are the enemies? Well, this woman thought big government was the enemy. And the second email had to do with, it turned out to be a joke, so the sender told me. It came from Australia. It was a series of cartoons from Australia that, to me, looked patently racist, ignorant, so superficially stupid, it's beyond belief that anybody thought that was humor or meaningful political discourse, is to see, what is the enemy? Well, we can look around and we can listen, if we are so inclined, to people say that Mexicans, illegal immigrants, people from Latin America are the enemy, or Muslims are the enemy, or Democrats are the enemy, or Republicans are the enemy, or Catholics are the enemy, or Protestants are the enemy, or non-Christians are the enemy, or the Chinese are the enemy, or gays are the enemy, or on and on. The poor are the enemy. Did I say blacks? Of course, blacks are the enemy. Everybody knows that. That's why our prisons are filled with blacks and Hispanics, blacks and browns. We whites know they're the enemy. Ignorance is the enemy. Ignorance is the enemy. And until we start recognizing the real enemy, we're going to be going through these obvious enemies and chasing them. We're going to go into fear because of our ignorance. With a little bit of consideration, some things seem to become so obvious, and I guess this is one of the things that I find odd, is that this is not noticed. We say we're the land of the free and home of the brave. That's part of our national identity. Land of the free, home of the brave. But I noticed during the last presidential administrations, George Bush and Dick Cheney, when it came time to serve in the military to display bravery, Dick Cheney got loopholes, or he found loopholes, to escape from serving 7 different times. And when questioned about it, he said he had other priorities. He had other priorities rather than be brave. George Bush, who used his family's political power to, at the last minute, get into the Air National Guard when it looked like he was going to be drafted, avoided being brave in Vietnam by joining the Air National Guard, home of the brave. Not for those two guys. Land of the free. Land of the free. It's disturbing, but somehow it gets overlooked that on the planet, the country with the greatest percentage of their population in prison, not free, is the United States of America. We have more people in our prisons, percentage-wise, than China, than Libya, than North Korea, than any place. The millions of people that are in our prisons are probably going, what land of the free? What land of the free? Now, any politician knows if you can talk about being tough on crime, that's going to get votes of people that are in fear about crime. But it makes me wonder why we don't look more deeply at crimes. When I was a kid, I don't know, maybe not elementary school, perhaps, but maybe junior high, I think that's the first time I came across in one of my classes a description of the Saudi Arabian justice system in which a person's hand was going to be hacked off with a sword because he had been caught stealing bread to feed his family. Now, that seemed crazy and barbaric beyond belief, that here is a man unable with two hands to provide food for his family, that he somehow, and society somehow, was going to be improved by hacking off one of his hands. Who benefited from him being a casualty on the battlefield between those that didn't have bread and those that did have bread? This guy? His family? Other people without bread? I don't think so. The only person that could possibly, in the short term, benefit from having this guy's hand hacked off would be people who had bread and they wanted to discourage anybody else from trying to get their bread. Why nobody thought about what are the chances of us expanding availability of bread. What is the opportunity here for us to expand the economy so that a man can do useful work, earn money, buy bread, render service, and support his family? Why don't we consider that? But that's not apparently what was considered. The savagery of hacking off a man's hand seemed a more enlightened point of view. There's a casualty of the battlefield. And I would say in a case like that, there's a battlefield between, on one side, the have-nots, people without bread, and on the other side, the people with bread. When I was in the military, I spent 4 years in Latin America, where this conversation always devolved into thoughts of communism versus freedom-loving democratic people. When a person said, I would like to provide food for my family, I would like to provide an education for my family, I would like to provide a healthy environment for my family, those people who already had that screamed communist, to which the American government and military quickly went to their support to prevent these communists, that is, the poor people, the uneducated people who wanted something better for their families, from getting it. The concentration of power and land and control and might into the hands of few people became important to us as a country because, of course, the poor and uneducated were communists. The poor and uneducated were poor and uneducated. They weren't communists. They couldn't spell communist any more than they could spell capitalist. They were uneducated. But this desire to feed their families, educate their families, this desire to have something better for their families, that existed well before anybody dreamed up capitalism and communism. Becoming a casualty on these battlefields requires us not to get sucked into these convenient enemies, in quotes, that are marketed to us. And so we can look at what's marketed to us by these people that are screaming on talk shows and news channels and on in the headlines. And who is the enemy? Who is the enemy? Well, in the United States of America, where our founding documents speak about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I would say anybody that's prohibiting our life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness could be considered the enemy, with no quotes, the enemy. Now, who is doing that? Who is doing that? Is it some guy with sand between his toes wearing a turban outside of Baghdad? I don't think so. I don't think so. Well, perhaps he is, because he has oil that we want. Maybe that's the problem. He has energy that we want as our own. But instead of getting involved in some legitimate form of exchange, why don't we just drum up some scenario of them being an enemy and them doing bad things, and we sucker our poor and undereducated to going, for the sake of honor, for the sake of my country, for the sake of my oil country companies, for the sake of my powerful, rich politicians and their benefactors, why don't I sacrifice my life and my body and my future and my family? I say, we should look deeper. We can avoid becoming casualties on these battlefields when we recognize these are created by other people for their benefit, not for our benefit. One of the disturbing things that I saw this week was in Time magazine that my wife bought for me. It's the November 2nd, 2009 issue of Time magazine. There is an article in here about a powerful lobbyist. This is the title. You don't know him. He's a lobbyist, but he may be the biggest winner in healthcare reform. So who loses? It's talking about this guy is the president and CEO of a lobbying organization, biotechnology industry organization. The biotechnology industry organization. In the first 6 months of the year, it says, the pharmaceutical industry spent about 600,000, actually, 609,000 a day. $609,000 per day for 6 months, influencing lawmakers to do their bidding. The pharmaceutical companies spent over $600,000 every day for 6 months to influence lawmakers to do their bidding. I find that unbelievable. And here's a quote from this guy named Jim Greenwood. He's the president and CEO. He says, "We've done very well." He's talking about the return on investment, both in the House and the Senate. "We've done very well. We carried a majority of Democrats and a majority of the Republicans in each of the committees, and by very clear margins." We carried a majority. We carried. He is actually saying he turned our elected official into prostitutes. He bought them. He bought them. He turned them into whores, and he's bragging about it, and he thinks it's a good thing. And he did it for his benefit. His benefit and the benefit of his organizations, the pharmaceutical companies. If this situation took place in the Old West, where somebody came in and rustled our cattle, or sheep would be a better description, he rustled our sheep, we would hang him by his neck until he was dead for rustling. That's a capital offense back in those days. If the politicians that he turned into whores had to obey a military standard of loyalty to the people that elected them, they would be put in front of firing squads and executed for treason. But here is a man and an organization with money who turned our elected official into whores, and he's glad and he thinks it's a good thing, and that's how the system works. It's clear to me who the enemy is. When we look at crime, as I mentioned, that's a buzzword for a lot of people. Oh my goodness, crime. I need a politician that's tough on crime. What's that? A politician that wants to hack off the hands of people who steal bread? Well, in our society, that's cruel. But what we do is the modern American version is we put them into prisons. That's why building prisons is a growth industry. We put them into prison. Now we have indentured or slave labor to do telemarketing and all kinds of other things. Pick up litter. It's an industry. It's an industry. We create rules so that when people violate the rules, they're now criminals. It's done to grow criminals. Our rules are done to grow criminals in some cases, for the benefit of some, at the cost, tremendous cost, to a lot of others. I see crime differently. On the one hand, no pun intended, no sick pun intended, that stealing a loaf of bread could be seen as a crime, but lack of availability of bread could be seen as a crime. To see people who are gluttonous standing on one side of the road from people who are starving to death could be seen as a crime. And so, what is the crime? What is a crime? Well, for those of us who are racist, we could look at it and say, crime is a normal behavior of less than human people, and we have to protect ourselves from it by locking up, by excluding those less than human people. That's clearly racist, but that's been around for a lot of years, and it's still a prevalent point of view. On the other hand, and this is where I would go, I would say crime is a little bit more complex than that. It's a behavior that involves a violation of a rule that was established by somebody. So there are rules that are violated. There are people who are taking actions to violate those rules for some purpose. There's an intention, there's a purpose, and there is a soil, there is a battlefield, there is a environment in which this is occurring. And when we start to see that weeds, maybe a crime, grow in certain climates, in certain environments, it will be right back to ignorance, uneducated, desperate, poor, no place to effectively use their energy. And if we think that we're going to have a group of human beings filled with energy with no useful place to apply it, and they're just going to sit there and do nothing with it, we are so out of touch. That is the beginning of a battlefield that needn't ever occur if we take time and some thought and some effort to providing education, opportunity, a level playing field, so people have something else to do other than to subject themselves, to submit themselves to being cannon fodder for the rich, for the powerful, for the controlling, for the greedy. If we use our own energy constructively, instead of to fight the enemies that are marketed to us, if we invest our energies in leveling the playing field, creating opportunities, developing ourselves, increasing our own experience, education, awareness, and helping others to do the same, instead of pretending that there's just not enough to go around and we have to prevent those other people from having bread or opportunity, we're all going to be a lot better off. Those people that make a living by building bombs and bullets and guns, weaponry, we say that there's a way to convert that talent, that equipment, into building something more life-enhancing than life-destroying. There's a lot of money to be made making bombs and bullets, but there can be a lot of money made in developing life-enhancing things. There's a huge market on this planet for people that don't have. The have-nots, instead of trying to keep them in the state of have-notness, is that's a marketplace ready to have. So let's make something other than bombs and bullets to sell them, to provide them. And when we recognize that that can be possible, all of a sudden, we might avoid sending our children or ourselves into these conflicts that are marketed by the media, marketed by pundits, marketed by the big mouths, to convince us of all the enemies that drive us into fight or flight, to deliberately reduce our awareness and distort our thinking and make us more primitive. We can avoid being battlefield casualties by using our ability to think and by connecting to some ideal above the primitive. People talk about being Christian, but when it comes time to connecting to the ideals that Jesus so clearly demonstrated, there seems to be a gap. Jesus displayed, he taught, he demonstrated, he modeled approaches to these global problems as well as local problems. But somehow, we listen to the serpents. They're in a different guise now than the one apparently that was in the Garden of Eden. And here's a point about prostitution. There's a joke that says prostitution is the oldest profession. I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true. I think that's done to demean women. This is truer. The oldest profession is either that of lobbyist or politician, depending on how you interpret the serpent in the garden. That pre-existed anybody selling their body, the lobbyist or the politician, coaxing people to do something basically destructive, pretending it was for their benefit. We can avoid falling prey to those folks. Even though they're glib, they're clever, we can take time, think, connect to the ideals that we've seen demonstrated, at least in theory. I would like to end this service with a prayer. Father God, Mother God, Christ, Creator in connection to all that is, thank you for all of our blessings. Help us to become aware of the stream of well-being that is you. Help us to stay in that and not be seduced by the sirens on the shore that would be screaming fear and hate and anger and greed that would try to coax us away from you. Help us to know we are blessed, and the best way to be blessed is to share the blessings that flow to us by having them flow through us, to bless as many other people on the planet, to bless as many things on the planet as we possibly can. Every time we bless somebody by having your light flow to us and through us, we bless ourselves, and we stay more deeply connected to you in our lives, for our health, for our happiness. And this stream of well-being could be considered success, happiness, health, and I will call it the healing spirit. Thank you. And it is so. Amen.